You're listening to a sermon by Janice Kreider, recorded on Sunday, September 7th, 2014, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
I'd like to give another welcome to the students. I know you've already been welcomed, but it's always exciting when you show up the first Sunday in September as part of your retreat. You probably forgot you signed up for Mennonite History 101. Not to worry. Today I'd like to tell a story, and to provide the context, I need to tell a little bit about some history. We're worshiping in a Mennonite congregation in the Menno Simons Center, obviously named for Menno Simons. And because the Mennonite denomination takes its name from Menno Simons, you might think he was the founder of the Mennonites, but surprisingly that's not the case. The new movement already existed. He was a Catholic priest in Holland, and he grew more and more disillusioned and disenchanted with the Catholic Church. Because of the corruption and, well, he just, and biblical, read the Bible, and he just felt he didn't fit in very well anymore. Europe in the early 1500s was pretty much totally Catholic, with the church and the governments of each country closely intertwined. But there was a big rupture. Things began to break apart. The condition of the peasants was deteriorating, but it was the intellectuals, who were mostly priests or monks at the time, who initiated the reform of the church because they saw practices that were not biblical. And Martin Luther was one of those priests. As well, he was a professor of theology. This movement was called the Reformation, and out of it came the Protestant Church. The Lutheran Church in Germany and Scandinavia, the Reformed Churches in Holland and Switzerland, and the Anglican Church in England. And of course, later there were more Protestant churches. France, Spain, and Italy remained mostly Catholic. Now, these were big changes. But even so, some university-educated people in Switzerland, still in their 20s, like some of you here in this chapel, wanted to see more. Two of those were Conrad Grebel and Felix Mons. They were bothered by the very close ties that remained between the Swiss Reformed Church and the Swiss government. They studied the Bible, and they did not see it supporting baptism of infants. Instead, they believed that there should be adult baptism and the church should be composed of those believers, not just people who happened to be born in a certain geographic area and got baptized as babies by their parents. Although their intentions were to get the Swiss Reformed Church to make further changes, it became clear to them that it would be impossible. These young people met one evening and held their own communion service. And then they spontaneously baptized each other with water from Lake Zurich. Of course, when the government authorities found out about that, they were not pleased. Out of their continued activism on the part of these young people emerged what is called the Radical Reformation. And it's also called Anabaptism, which meant rebaptizing, not anti-baptism, or anti-Baptists. We once had a woman come to this chapel, and she heard about Anabaptism, and she thought we were talking about anti-Baptists, and she never came back. The movement very rapidly caught on with the Swiss country folk and spread throughout Europe. And this is the movement that Menno Simons was attracted to and worked tirelessly for throughout the rest of his life, and which honors him by having the major strand of the Anabaptist movement, Mennonite, named after him. And the good thing was he no longer had to be celibate. Now, back to those Swiss peasants. My story today has its origins there, and I can say this because I'm nearly 100% Swiss, but not totally, as we'll hear today. The Swiss people can be very bloody-minded with strong views. In their simple but obstinate ways, these early Anabaptist peasants began to be a challenge to both the government and the church because they did not baptize their babies. They did not participate in the military. They refused to swear an oath of allegiance to the government because they believed swearing was wrong. And they did not participate in their local Swiss Reform congregation. They had their own meetings in their homes with their own leaders. This may not sound very strange or radical to us because we share a lot of those beliefs today. But it was too much for the Swiss government authorities. The Anabaptists were killed. Felix Mons, before he was 30, put in prison. Conrad Grebel was in prison and lost his health somewhere along the way and died before he was 30. They were banished. Their land and possessions were taken away. But the villages where they lived were their homes. That is where their relatives were. And some of their neighbors, who were called half-Anabaptists, protected them. However, in the end, many of them left Switzerland and went north to Germany and France and other places. Some went to the Alsace and worked for landowners there, but Louis XIV of France made a law evicting them in 1712. Eventually, most of my ancestors ended up in a region south of the Alsace in France called Franche-Comté, which you've probably never heard of because it's not a tourist place, but it's where the Comté cheese comes from if you've ever eaten any of that. The Anabaptist families were scattered in various villages and farms wherever the family could find work for a local landlord. Most of this happened to be Lutheran territory. In Montbéliard, a city just west of Basel, the church center for the Anabaptists was set up. This is where the church leaders kept a register in German or French language of baptisms, marriages, and deaths of their members. These people were known in the French language as Anabaptistes, and today many of the French congregations are known as Église Evangélique Mennonite. Now we'll skip to Austria. Although the Anabaptist movement spread all over Europe, the persecutions meant that life as a practicing Anabaptist was very dangerous. So the movement became small and basically disappeared in many places. One of those places was Austria, which remained Catholic. In Western Austria, there is a province which is mountainous, like Switzerland. Today, the area is a fancy ski area, but in the mid-1800s, there were no ski resorts there, I'm pretty sure. And a young man, Catholic, of course, named Andreas Vanier, was looking for work. He was trained as a stonemason. Perhaps he had an agent, we don't know, but somehow he ended up in France, in a small, remote village called Etobon, in Franche-Comté, where there was a keen Lutheran pastor who wanted to rebuild, or maybe build, the local church building, which had originally been built in the first 15th century for the Catholics before the region became Lutheran. And it became Lutheran because a new lord took over and everyone had to become Lutheran. Of course, Andreas spoke a dialect of German and the villagers spoke French. Except for one family of Anabaptists that had come out of Switzerland, the Geimann family. Likely their dialect was different, but Andreas found some affinity with this family. Perhaps he even boarded with them. Soon after the rebuilding of the church began, two of the unmarried Geimann daughters became pregnant. Back then, there were no DNA tests, so the father of these two babies can't be proven, But family tradition is that Andreas was the father of both of them. Now, what to do? This was a big problem for this Anabaptist family. Not only was Andreas Catholic, and Anabaptists weren't allowed to marry Catholics, if they did, they had to leave their church, but there were two sisters in big trouble. Having a child as an unmarried woman was not that uncommon, but usually a marriage partner could be found and the child would be adopted by the groom, whether or not it was actually his biological child. From some of my reading, I think the Anabaptist church leaders helped to arrange marriages in those days. How would you react if you were one of those sisters? What would you do if you were the parents of those two women? What would you do if you were Andreas? What would you advise if you were a church leader? The two sisters were Catherine and Françoise. Catherine was the older sister. She was 29 years old, already the mother of three daughters, and a widow of a couple of years. Her husband had died a few years before. We don't know how. She gave birth to a boy named, not surprisingly, André. André being the French equivalent of Andreas. The younger sister, Françoise, was 21 and single. Less than 3 months later, she also gave birth to a boy named Christ for her father. Somehow the decision was made for Catherine to be the one to marry Andreas. Perhaps this was because she already had children that needed a father, or maybe because she was the older sister, or maybe she liked Andreas, even though he was unfaithful to her. So when little André was 4 months old, Catherine and Andreas had a civil marriage, and little André was adopted by the new husband as part of the legal proceedings. However, coming from a long line of Anabaptist ancestors, Catherine wanted to remain a practicing Anabaptist on good terms with her church. Marrying a Catholic meant leaving the church, as I mentioned before. And here is the remarkable part of the story. A few weeks after their civil marriage, there is a record of their marriage in the church register in Montbéliard, a long paragraph. Instead of the usual brief listing, there had to be explanations, and it isn't totally clear what happened. Somehow, an exception was made for this marriage. Perhaps Andreas was rebaptized, but that's unclear. The church, quote, worked with, unquote, them, and there is a mention of the pregnancy. The record is in German, and since I don't read German, I asked Peter Newdorf to translate it for me, since he's familiar with his old German writing. But it's still fairly obscure what's going on. What is clear is that the church leader who signed the record bent some of the rules in this case. In the Romans passage, we read, "You shall not commit adultery." But we also read, "Love is the fulfilling of the law." There is always a delicate balance between broken rules and love. The church leaders in this case chose love. I am thankful for two reasons. One is that Catherine and Andreas are my great-great-grandparents, as you've probably guessed. The other is that the Anabaptist background did not get dropped. If the church leaders had held strictly to their church doctrines, my ancestors would have been kicked out of the church, and at most they would have ended up being lapsed Catholics, as is typical in France nowadays. The Anabaptist background would have disappeared. I wouldn't exist. And if I did exist, I wouldn't be here. The family ended up sending young André to Ohio when he was a teenager because, being Anabaptist, they did not want him conscripted into the French army. The rest of the family followed a few years later after suffering through the Franco-Prussian War. Catherine went on to have seven more children, one of them being another Françoise, or Fanny, as she was known in Ohio, my great-grandmother. And as I said before, I have a picture of her up here. In Ohio, Andreas continued his masonry profession, being away from the family on projects much of the time as he was in France. Having a problem with alcohol and having little association with either the Mennonite or the Catholic Church. But we've left an unfinished strand to the story. What happened to the poor Françoise who gave birth to Christ? It took some time for her to get married. There may have been a stigma attached to the Guymon family following their difficulties. I think there probably was. When she was 26, she finally married a 37-year-old Anabaptist widower from another village whose wife had died the year before. As in the civil marriage of Catherine, her son Christ was adopted by the new husband. The family also immigrated to Ohio. We don't know if this was a happy marriage. In any case, there were no more children. Françoise died at age 45, a few years after immigrating, and is buried in a cemetery next to her husband and next to her sister Catherine, who died later at age 58. Andreas is buried elsewhere, as he went on to marry a new younger wife and begat 7 more children. I like to think that because Catherine and her sister Françoise are buried next to each other, that they were close and forgiving sisters. There was one other sister that immigrated, but perhaps these two were closer. The rest of the Guymon family remained in France, and there are more stories about this family, but this is enough for today. And I'd like to note that there are many stories that people in this congregation could tell you about their ancestors fleeing extreme danger and facing many difficulties. Now, this certainly wasn't a sermon. It wasn't even a Bible story. But it's a story about real people dealing with real problems, making compromises, forgiving, trying to be faithful to their beliefs. And many of our Bible stories are like that too. Imperfect people, compromises. And yet we can see the hand of God at work for the good. Think of Moses, who killed an Egyptian. Saul, who was paranoid. David, who got someone else's wife pregnant. Elijah, who thought he was the only faithful one in the whole country. And even many of Jesus' disciples who were on the wrong track at many times in their thinking. Is it important to remember these old stories? In the passage from Exodus, we read, "This day shall be a day of remembrance for you, for the Jewish people to remember their origins." As we remember our own stories or our family stories, do we see the hand of God working? After you are no longer alive, what stories will your close friends or your children tell about you? From today's story, what lessons can we learn? I'm going to sum up with 3. Mercy, faithfulness, and courage. Mercy on the part of the Anabaptist church leaders. Faithfulness on the part of Catherine. And courage on the part of those young activists who stuck by their beliefs despite persecution.